Reform reformers? That's it. No one's getting a grade. Is it time for the Dems to take a look in the mirror? I'm talking to you, Schumer. Plus, Cone Zone, Matt Damon's mom, and more. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio. Fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
Are you kidding me? A better deal? From Ian Haney Lopez at BillMoyers.com, the Democratic Party is, number one, a party of swamp creatures, number two, a party afraid of equality, three, a boring party with limited ambitions, and four, a party on a new marketing kick. Not really sensing the love there, are you? And how about this from Stephen Thrasher over at The Guardian? Quote, 6 months into Donald Trump's term, and Democrats' ability to be an opposition party is, in a word, pathetic, end quote. I know it's a little beating around the bush, but I get the sense that Mr. Thrasher is a bit disappointed in the Dems, too. But why? Aren't the Democrats the party of bold ideas? You know, that New Deal? You know, social justice warriors, human rights advocates. Hey, according to Hannity and Limbaugh, that's exactly who they are. But if you happen to be just a plain old Democratic voter, you're probably thinking more like Lopez and Thrasher. The party and its elite leadership are too busy sucking... Oh, wait, that's Scaramucci's line on Bannon. Hold on. How about this? For regular Democrats, the party just doesn't quite know how to party anymore. But hold the phone. Senator Chuck Schumer was just seen leaving a telephone booth in red underwear. What? I know what you're thinking, but I'm sorry. People still know what red underwear look like. Phone booths? Maybe not so much. Anyway, according to the eyewitnesses, the Democratic senator had a New York Times op-ed in hand. What say the op-ed? How about a better deal? That's right. The Democrats are offering a better deal with a realization that the party may not have been very responsive to the needs of regular voters. In fact, according to Senator Schumer, quote, Democrats have too often hesitated from taking on those misguided policies directly and unflinchingly, so much so that many Americans don't know what we stand for. Not after today. Democrats will show the country that we're the party on the side of working people, and that we stand for three simple things. Democrats will propose policies to increase people's pay, reduce everyday expenses, and provide workers with tools for the modern economy. As my friend Jonathan Pelto would say, wait, what? Dems are going to increase my pay, reduce my expenses, and give me tools. You want to hear that again? Increase, reduce, tools. How's that for a better deal? WTF, right? No boldness, no human rights, no social justice. Just BS words meant to calm the peasant class. Because that's the reality, isn't it? Schumer and the Democratic leadership haven't got a damn clue about what it's like to live paycheck to paycheck with a sick kid in braces and one about to go to college while paying off student loan expenses. Hey, that's just me. I'm living the dream. But what about those that are truly the least of these? No effing clue. Better deal from the Democrats? As Al from Tool Time used to say, I don't think so, Tim. But hey, let's not forget, this is also the party that couldn't even stop the confirmation of an unqualified billionaire who hates public schools from becoming the Secretary of Education. You know, come to think of it, there's been a lot of blame hoisted on Trump people for DeVos. But let's be honest, with strategies like a better deal, isn't it really the fault of the Democrats? You know, I wonder what Matt Damon's mom thinks.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask her.
So Nancy, yeah. Diane Ravitch has a new piece out about the fact that Betsy DeVos and the reason she's here, Democrats.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, it's Republicans and Democrats. It's just that the Democrats paved the way for her.
So you're okay. You're okay with that position that
the 100%.
Okay.
100%. I believe. I'm absolutely. Yeah. I've just put my boxing gloves on for this one. This situation that we're in it because the Democrats sold out on public education, and they really betrayed the people and their core values for equity and for equal educational opportunity for all children, they gave it up. It started with Bill Clinton. He started talking about national achievement and testing. And then when we got to Obama, some of us were hoping, mm-hmm. although I always feared it, but hoping that there would be a reverse in what we'd seen with, you know, the testing and choice agenda. And then, you know, he really doubled down on the whole thing with Race to the Top. It was heartbreaking and shocking. I've never recovered from it, and I haven't understood what happened there. It must be, and in that article, Diane Ravitch tries to lay out a few different motives. I mean, there are probably multiple motives. I mean, why did they sell out on public education? Did some of them actually believe that the choice model was going to benefit all kids? I don't see how you could if you understand how it works.
Well, it made no sense. And I remember, you know, again, as I said, this bipartisan. And as you said, we can go back to Clinton. We can go, you know, with Goals 2000 and easily trace this.
Right.
You know, what I've seen, some of the criticism of Diane's article has been, you know, well, you know, they really hammered her hard, and they voted really hard to try to keep her out of being Secretary of Education. And it's like, well, wait, you're missing the point. We're not saying that those Democrats, and, well, you know, it wasn't that hard to hit somebody so unqualified at the point, but it's the paving the way for the idea of somebody like Betsy DeVos that I think a lot of people were missing here. And that's, you did a really nice, you know, nice job by tracing this back. But I think about this, you know, bipartisanship,
yeah.
No Child Left Behind, there was back slapping, you know, probably shots being thrown over mm-hmm. shoulders with Democrats and Republicans. I mean, it was, you know, the earth was about to crack. I mean, there had never been such bipartisanship on No Child Left Behind. And
now what you see with Trump and DeVos in their education policy, it's an easy next step. It's a natural next step from everything that has led to this point. And that's on Obama, and that's on Clinton, and of course it's on the Republicans. And I will say, too, on a lot of progressive Democrats who have not spoken out on education nearly the way they should have. Bernie starts making some sounds now, but it's way too late. Always too afraid to come out and really speak the truth about this. They never wanted to take it on. And they didn't want to go against Obama either.
Yeah, it's too late. And you know, that's the part that drives me crazy here, both locally and in Wisconsin, you know, where Busted Pencils is recorded. I mean, the, quote, progressive Democrats' refusal in Wisconsin to take on public education as, mm-hmm. you know, a way to possibly even rebuild the party. They just don't see the fact that it has such unifying ability to come around. You know, we're talking about what's best for our kids, what's best for our communities, what's best. And you think, if you can rally around public education and frame it that way about what's best for kids, what's best for communities, you can reestablish yourselves. But yet I have seen reluctance on Democrats still to take up, other than, like they said, during the DeVos confirmation, sure, a couple of senators, you know, gave her a hard time, whatever. But
yeah.
You know what? Here it is. And I still have not seen one progressive platform on public education since Betsy DeVos has been in. All I've seen is people complaining about her, and thank goodness they are complaining about her, but nobody's putting forward any type of progressive education, public education platform that would say, here's what we should be doing instead.
You know that when I went into education, it was an era when what was talked about in the late 60s and very early 70s was equal educational opportunity. It was full of idealism. It was full of beliefs about desegregation and equity and equal opportunity. And it was inspiring to go into the education field at that time. And many of us, when we were young and choosing our careers, chose education because of that. And the Democrats were very behind those values. These current Democrats since Clinton have really betrayed those those values of the party and the people, and all the poor people now who have been suffering in their communities because of what's happened with charter schools, market-based ed reform, testing, and how it's hit so hard in low-income areas where there are children of color primarily. You know, the inequality and injustice is so much more extreme now, and none of these Democratic leaders are talking about it. Politicians are talking about it.
So come back to the question, should Democrats be blamed for Betsy DeVos, Matt Damon's mom? What say you?
I say absolutely, yeah. The Democrats paved the way for where we are now, and I don't know what they're thinking, but they must understand it was a baby step to go into vouchers from where this all had led. So, yeah, they paved the way, and do I think some of them know it? Probably, but they don't say it out loud.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
He was with the Colorado Department of Education. He was the superintendent at Eagle County Schools in Eagle, Colorado. He was also the commissioner of education for the state of Iowa. And now he is the superintendent of the second largest district in Colorado. That would be Jefferson County. Jason Glass, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tim. Thanks for having me. I'm excited about our conversation.
So you're going to bust some pencils, in other words.
Well, maybe we're past pencils. We're going to bust keyboards now.
Okay, we're going to bust some. But we got so. Listen, let's just, you know, your long line of credentials. But what turned me on was this, you know, this article back in Chalkbeat a while ago saying Jeffco's pick for superintendent changed his mind about reform. And so, in other words, you're a reformed reformer.
Yeah, some might say that, and I guess. I would say that I'm still a believer in reform, but I just think the word reform has come to mean a very specific thing in the American context, and I think that specific thing are things that are not working very well for us. So these efforts toward accountability, punitive-based measures, test and punish, market-based approaches, all of which have their place, but they don't seem to be drivers for quality. So I'm still about change and trying to make things better and keep moving forward and improving and innovating. But I just think we've been going about it in some ways that aren't very effective.
So in other words, you're going to be our first national superintendent to try to reclaim that word reform and bring it back to where it belongs, which was where we were starting before the crazy reform accountability movement took over and kind of sent us in the wrong direction and say, look, we want to do things that really work for kids.
Yeah, and I think it has to be things that get down to that student experience level. And so when we think about things like mass testing and accountability systems or teacher evaluation and human resource process changes or opening more charter schools or privatizing education, certainly there are some things that we might look at those as far as how they might improve the system. But if we're not getting down to changing the experience of the student mm-hmm. in some profound and meaningful way, we're not really changing anything. So I think we've got to reclaim this idea of reform and bring it back to, are we really making the learning experience for the student different?
So, I mean, you know, simple question. People are out there going, so Jason, I mean, what changed? I mean, what happened? How did you, you know, and again, we're limited by what the press and how the press paints certain people because people are much more complex than the press presents them. But, you know, some of the early things put you at, you know, he's a merit pay person. He's a test driven person. But there was a change and something happened. I mean, what was it that made you go, you know what, maybe some of this marketized reform based stuff really isn't working? Was there a moment? Was there an episode? Did something happen?
I think it was a couple of experiences that I had in Iowa when I was the commissioner or the director, as they call that position there.
Okay.
And assuming that role, which is really a state level, you have state level responsibility, so you're trying to improve the entire state system. So I got really interested in studying other systems that had been successful, which led me into Mark Tucker's work and a lot of thinking around this approach called international benchmarking, where you look at systems around the world and systems within the United States that have been successful and try to emulate their practices within your context. And what that international benchmarking study did for me was open my eyes to many of the reforms that we've been pursuing in the United States were not being used in these international high-performing systems. They tend to focus on improving the teaching profession by considering it a profession that not everybody can or should do. It's a high-status, highly selective, highly regarded field. They work on customizing the instruction to fit the student. They work on aligning their instructional experiences to high standards and expectations. And they have community-wide or really country-wide systems that work to mitigate the effects of poverty. So those four big areas are what I learned in studying systems that actually were successful, and it really awakened me that the agenda and the path that we were on in Iowa that I had been on as a professional wasn't going to be effective at lifting in a whole system. So it caused me to do an about-face and really try to approach reform and improving schools through some different drivers.
Well, that's interesting to think of that, though, as the commissioner, the director in Iowa, the entire state of Iowa. I mean, from what I've read, you were hired in that position because of, quote, your reform-mindedness. Was there a sense when you decided, like, hey, you know what, I think some of this is not necessarily the direction to go? Did the people that were responsible for getting you to that position start to say, well, Jason, these are the reforms we want. We want testing. We want international benchmarking that really isn't international benchmarking.
Right.
We should throw that in. We're not comfortable with this change of heart you've had. I mean, was...
Yeah. Well, I worked for a Republican administration in Iowa, Governor Terry Branstad, who was and is the longest-serving governor in the history of the United States. And our first year there, we ran a pretty traditional American reform bill that was testing, value-added, accountability, evaluation, expanded school choice. So it was pretty much the standard book of approaches that we've seen roll out across the whole country. And it just flopped miserably in the legislature. It didn't go anywhere. So it really caused us to step back and regroup and think about, okay, we want to get something done. And I think I'm grateful to have worked for a very pragmatic governor. And when I went to him and said, I think we've been working on the wrong stuff, I think we need to pivot and look at these other approaches. And I think what we have been doing isn't going to be successful here. He was open to that and said, hey, you write it the way you write our bill the way that you think it needs to be to make Iowa a better system, and we'll work that through. And that's what we did. So I'm grateful for that experience. The governor and I certainly didn't always agree on everything, but I think in his heart he was a pragmatist, and I really appreciate that.
Well, I mean, that's great. I mean, it's good to hear that somebody decided that, hey, somebody who is in a position who's supposed to be an expert, we hired him to be the expert in this position, went out and learned some things and is coming back and trying to inform. It's a breath of fresh air to hear that regardless, Republican, Democrat, Independent, somebody said, you know what, Jason's the expert. He learned. He went out. We're going to follow his advice. I'd like to see that, you know, happen more and more as we continue to go, and maybe we'll check back in with you over the years to see if you're going to continue pushing that type of enlightenment across Colorado. But so now you're at Jefferson County, and it's the second largest school district in Colorado. People in Jefferson County, I know I have some really good friends, have some big expectations. So what should they be expecting from your administration?
Well, I think initially in Jeffco, what people can expect is for me to do a lot of listening and getting out and meeting people. So I tell people that I think the first couple of times I got off the elevator here, I got off on the wrong floor. So I don't have any business making big sweeping changes or structural changes immediately. I need to understand the context and the landscape before we start doing anything. So now that I'm getting off on the right floor and getting to know people and getting to know some of the history here and some of the efforts that have been underway, that'll allow me to make some, I think, meaningful changes going forward that are the right fit for this community, because that's really all, what it's all about. Every education organization should be engaged in positive and forward motion change, but you have to tailor that to the context that you're in, and so that's what I'm going to be doing, is trying to figure out what that context is. But I think also, I mean, you can look at at my sort of history and approach, and you see these elements of the international benchmarking coming through again, that raising the teaching profession, customization of learning to the student, alignment to high expectations, community approach to mitigating poverty. I mean, those are foundational elements that are certainly going to be part of our effort here.
Well, I tell you what, just take those right there and put them down, and you have my vote as the next president of the United States, because, I mean, that's the solution right there. I mean, you know, poverty, teaching profession, strong curriculum that's relevant. My goodness, it's, you know, we think about these things, and sometimes, you want, for at least being in this position, you know, I'm the dean of the School of Education, and, you know, you've had this, you feel like driving your head sometimes, because what you just laid out, now they're not easy things to solve, We know the research says, look, you want to deal with some of the hardest core issues hurting our students' learning abilities, you've got to jump into poverty. If you want really deep, committed, professional teachers, you've got to treat them and make sure that they're coming from a great place. You know, we curriculum, when you talk about international benchmarking, what are they doing in other places that is working, truly working, and how are they bringing it about? And then that insertion to the community, I think, Jason, is really refreshing for me to hear coming from you, because I look at that from an academic standpoint, and that's one that I hear that's not talked about as much, and recognizing that when you bring all of that together, the profession, you know, looking, addressing the needs of the community, which would be poverty, and then the curriculum, you've got a whole package there. I mean, how did you put all these together?
Well, it's really just learning from these other high-performing systems, many of which are within the United States, and seeing what they had done to be successful. And, you know, you talked about it, that they're really sort of straightforward concepts, but they're notoriously difficult to stay focused on. Mm-hmm. You can't talk to anybody who doesn't have their answer about what we need to be doing differently to improve schools. Everybody's an expert on education when you go out and talk to the community. So I think the work is really having these as the core values of how you're approaching your change or your improvement, and then sticking with them for the years that it takes to really make a difference in these areas and get good at them. So I think the hard work ahead is not only identifying or just saying these four critical concepts of what we're going to be focused on, but having the wherewithal, the toughness, the focus to stay laser sharp, intently focused on those things for the years that it takes to make a difference.
Well, there's one that really has my interest, being the dean of a school of education, where my primary responsibility is the future educators that are coming out, and recognizing the quote, some people are saying we have a national shortage. I even saw one of your texts. I tweeted back to you that I don't think it's a shortage, it's an exodus. But I agree with you. We are never going to, quote, get at what's best for kids unless we make sure we have the best teachers. What are your thoughts on the quote, you know, for now, let's call it a shortage, but if we're facing a shortage, how do we get the best people in when we know the best people are what our children deserve?
Yeah, great point. Well, I think you have to start with the decision about whether or not teaching is a profession or not. And if we believe that it is a profession, and we say that, then we've got to back that up with some decisions that are in alignment with that statement. So if teaching is a profession, that means that we're damn selective about who we let in. The training, the pre-service training, is intense and of quality. It includes a authentic, meaningful residency or practical, hands-on experience as part of that. The hiring process is selective, and then the ongoing supports once on the job are throughout the whole career, and there are opportunities for teachers to grow and evolve and keep getting better at the craft. I mean, it takes years to really become a great teacher, and that's a profession. So if we believe teaching is a profession and we value that, then our actions have to back up those values, and we have to create systems all along the way that deliver on those elements of a real profession.
And Busted Pencils and the listeners would, I'm sure, agree 100% with you, Dr. Glass, but I'm confused when I look around the country, and I look here in my own state of Wisconsin, I look at Arizona, I look at Utah, And while we'll admit that we need teachers, when I see the solutions to needing teachers seem to more revolve around devaluing the profession and, in fact, deregulating and deprofessionalizing and taking away experiences that we know are good for teachers. Thoughts?
Yeah, we automatically, I think, jump to lowering our standards in the face of a shortage or not having enough teachers. And I think that's profoundly the wrong approach to this. The shortage issues, especially in rural areas, are real. But instead of lowering our standards to say basically anybody with a high school degree who is not a felon should be able to be a teacher, I mean, we may even be eroding that as a standard. We need to be instead saying, how do we change the incentive programs, the compensation programs? How do we make the field more attractive? How do we make the art and science of teaching something that is attractive to more people? How do we build a pipeline into specifically rural communities where we're attracting people in those communities to stay and become teachers? And I'm not opposed to alternative pathways, although they all of those pathways need to be of high quality and have those kind of experience-based pedagogical selectivity elements that a profession should have. So I would agree that we need to be expanding opportunities to become teachers, but we need to keep an eye on quality through all of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't disagree. It's the idea, though. If it's a profession, though, there are, quote, some standards that we need to uphold across the profession. And some of the ideas of, as you just said, you know, whether it's a high school degree and not a felon, which is, you know, let's remind everybody, that's the requirements to be a school board member. You know,
I'm not going to touch that one, Tim.
Okay, well, that's your base requirement. I mean, you can obviously be an extremely successful school board member, but yeah, when we talk about lowering the standards, it's refreshing to hear somebody with your experiences, the time you've had in Iowa and Colorado, now back leading again, like you said, the second largest school district in the state of Colorado, and recognizing that one of those issues first internationally, how you're going to talk about community. And I really look forward to this idea that of your sense of understanding the teaching profession and what needs to happen. And let's be honest, we're talking about, people will always say, oh, you're just talking about what's best for adults. No, I'm making this decision. I'm making this discussion point. I'm trying to advocate for the profession of teaching because I think, as you would agree, we're in this because we're trying to do what's best for kids.
I think every student deserves a passionate, committed, well-trained professional educator, regardless of where they are. All our children deserve that. So if that's what we really believe, and we believe in a teaching profession, then our question should be, how do we build a system within our states that delivers on that outcome?
Well, he is Dr. Jason Glass. He is the new superintendent for Jefferson County Schools in Colorado, and he just busted pencils, as we like to say. Jason, good luck to you. Keep us informed, and thanks for your time.
Hey, Tim, I'm glad to be here. I enjoyed it so much. Thank you.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
Okay, before we go any further, I need to make sure everyone knows what a rubric is. Look, a rubric is simple. It's a box. It's got words in it. Those words try to communicate to the student what it is they need to do to get awarded the number in that box. If the student does what the words in the box say, the box corresponding number is then awarded to the student. In other words, it's a way of spending way too much time providing a student with a number on an assignment that has words associated with it. Well, you'll get it in a minute. She's a high school English teacher in central Wisconsin. She also has her own blog where she writes about teaching English. And more specifically lately, she's been talking about this really cool stuff, quantification, measurement, or how do we actually tell kids they're learning? Welcome to Busted Pencils, Jen Doucette.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, so check it out. Two blog posts, Reaching the Crossroads, Quantify the Unquantifiable. Okay. The first one, though, I wanted to start there.
Okay.
Because you kind of take apart something that most people thought was an alternative way to measure. You've got a problem with rubrics.
Absolutely.
So what did you write about?
That's kind of been, that post was kind of the culmination of a 2-year journey for me.
It took you 2 years to write a blog post?
No.
Okay, good.
No, but to get to that point, the epiphany that I kind of had when I wrote that post, it did. 2 years ago, I read Maya Wilson's Rethinking Rubrics book. If you've never read it, it's a good starting place where she talks a lot about why we have rubrics and what they were created for. And I used rubrics through my first 13 years of teaching, definitely all the time, to help expedite my grading and to be efficient. But what I found was that I was having a lot of problems with rubrics because I was manipulating them to give students the grades I wanted them to have, because I would read a piece of writing and think, well, that doesn't fit into this box, so I want to adjust the box to fit the piece to give it the grade I thought deserved.
I think most people who listen to Busted Pencils understand what rubrics are, but let's be honest. Let's explain it. When you say box, it is a box. We put words in that box that say we're looking for an expectation. The student sees those words and says, that's what I want to do, some type of measure. And we somehow try to think that that's not a linear measurement.
Absolutely. And I think what happens, too, when we do that is that we look at that rubric and the kids look at the rubric as the be-all, end-all, and it limits creativity and it limits any kind of student voice.
So standardized testing, rubrics as an answer to the standardized objective test, you're saying, nah, not really.
Oh, absolutely not. It does make it efficient to look at, and it makes it easier to grade, easier for some perhaps. But I don't think that that's the answer to any of that, no.
Well, I like what you pointed out there, and in fact is that the students themselves start to perform exactly as the rubric tells them to.
Absolutely.
So stifling creativity.
100%. They will do as much as the rubric says and nothing more.
So for all the proponents out there that are saying, look, if you want to move away from standardized testing, you need to bring rubrics into play. Jen, the English teacher, with a blog saying, I'm not so sure.
Absolutely. The minute the rubric disappears, the kids look at you stymied and say, well, now what? And I say, most of the time, I shrug my shoulder and say, well, what do you have to say? And it takes them a while to figure out that they have something to say independent of what they think I want them to say.
See, that's the other interesting part of what we say is that the kids get stuck in that rubric, mm-hmm. and as when you say you pull it away from them, they're almost paralyzed for a while, right?
100%. Yeah, they don't even know where to go next.
It's like, I don't know how to write for because you want me to write.
Mm-hmm.
I need to know how to write. I need to know how many sentences. I need to know the topic. I need to know the length of the sentences. I want to know all these things because I want to know how to get an A.
The last thing you said is the exact truth. That is exactly what they want to know, because that's what kids would say. Well, what do you want me to do now?
Right. And you pulled that away from them.
I did.
Oh, my God.
I did.
What kind of teacher are you?
I know. A crazy one, I think, at times.
Jeez. That's all. But that's great. I mean, this points out the fact where for so many people who love, put it in the rubric, that'll help you break away and allow students. No, it doesn't.
I agree, but you know, it's interesting. I also think that rubric paralyzes teachers too, because I think we find ourselves stuck in that box as well, and we're teaching this one set of skills over and over and over again. And so I think when I pulled the rubric away from myself, that was also an illumination of, okay, now what for me?
Okay, so now this last post, quantifying the unquantifiable, what's happening there?
Well, that came back to after I got rid of the rubric, I got rid of lots of things, including grades on all essays. So I don't grade any of that anymore. I do a quarterly grade instead. So that comes back to the problem of now that I've eliminated points and grades, I still am accountable to an SLO, an educator effectiveness, and I have no points and I have no grades.
Yeah, because I was going to stop you and say, wait a minute. You're currently a public school teacher, right?
I am.
In America, where we measure everything.
Correct.
Okay, and you've now decided somehow you're going to try to move away from points and numbers.
Correct.
On students' essays.
Yeah, I don't put any numbers. For the last 2 years, no numbers on any essay, any writing assignment that students do. It's gone.
Oh, my.
Yeah, I know. I know.
How's that working?
You know, it's interesting. Students have varying responses, especially initially. Kids will rewrite and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite until I tell them we're done. Like, okay, great. You've done a great job on this assignment. Let's do the next one. And they'll say, but what did I get?
Back to that same problem as the rubric, right? They still, I'm writing for a grade, Ms. Doucette.
Correct. And I'll say, well, you got, you know, you learned all the, and I would come back usually with, what did you learn? And they would tell me what they learned. Well, I learned about, you know, whatever. And at the end of it, they still said, but I know, but what did I get?
Right.
I said, well, you got permission to move to the next paper. Let's go.
Okay, so the students have a problem with it. What Correct. About the, you know, just the whole system? Doesn't the system have a problem with what you're doing? Granted, I love it. I think it's great. But how does a public school system that's built on, let's be, you know, we're measuring you all the time as a teacher through your kids, through the amount of time you're spending in your classroom. Everything is quantifiable. And you've decided, no, not anymore, at least in this one section. So the kids are a little bit, but what about peers? What about, you know, principals? What about, you know, parents?
This is good questions. That's kind of where I came to in that piece. I think my peers, some I think agree and some I think don't. But the people that I teach the classes with kind of go along and they definitely help foster that. My administration has been really wonderful, to be perfectly honest. I've pitched everything to them with research and asked for permission and they've let me run with it. But I definitely had a moment at the end of the school year this year where I realized I had no data. Quantifiable data, perhaps, is a better thing to say because I had lots of anecdotal data, I couldn't validate.
But listen to how you've already said, you know, well, I don't have quantifiable data.
I know.
As if that's a bad thing, and I only have anecdotal data. So in other words, you have real data about real kids, about real learning, but that doesn't count.
And that's my fear because I filled out an SLO.
SLO
Barely.
Is a student learning objective.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'm supposed to have three different categories, like three different data
points.
And
you can't prove that a student learning objective was met through, quote, anecdotal notes and qualitative data?
I'm not sure. I certainly tried. I put all of that in the form. But when I look at, and the irony of this does not escape me, the rubric to grade the SLO, I went, oh, this doesn't work out well for me at the end.
So how do you put these two systems together, or can we? Do they? I mean, are you just on the edge?
That's a really good question. I end that second blog with, I know I don't fit into a traditional educational system, but I'm not ready to go anywhere. I like what I'm doing. I feel like what I'm doing is right for the kids. I watch at the end of the semester, you know, when they ask them, what have you learned? What have you, you know, what is your biggest growth? And they say these miraculous things. And I think, yes, for the first time in my teaching career, I really feel like what I'm doing is right. And for the first time in my teaching career, I feel like a total outlier. And I don't know how I got to those two places, but here I sit.
Outliers are typically leaders. So, Jen, keep busting pencils.
Thank you. I'm trying.
This topic of rubrics, you know, it can get a bit confusing. I think what we need here, we need to talk to an education guru, someone who gets it, someone who knows it, someone like Alfie Cohn. I think it's time to enter Cohn's zone. We're not going to give grades anymore because we are moving into a more holistic way of communicating to students their accomplishments. We're using rubrics.
Not so fast, say I.
Okay.
First of all, too often rubrics are just used to yield grades. So you get the worst of both worlds as opposed to finding truly authentic assessment that is an alternative to grades. And let's pause here just for a moment to review why we're moving away, hopefully, from grades and not just juicing them up with the latest fad of calling them standards-based grades or something.
Okay.
The research shows that grades have three robust effects. First, they lead kids to become less interested in the learning itself, whatever the topic was or the whole field. Every study I've been able to find that has looked at intrinsic motivation in graded and non-graded conditions has found that grades kill interest in learning. The second effect is that grades lead kids to try to pick the easiest possible task, not because they're lazy, but because they're rational. And the third effect is that grades lead kids to think in a more superficial fashion. They're less focused on understanding the idea and more focused on what do I have to do in order to get the higher grade. And let me emphasize this. All of this applies, these three effects, whether kids get good grades or bad grades. The relevant distinction is not between getting an A and getting a C. The relevant distinction is between kids who are trying to get good report cards because that's what they're being pressured to do, and those lucky enough to go to schools that don't use grades at all. Okay, now the important thing to realize is not only that we have to get rid of them, not merely use rubrics to produce them, but we have to understand that those same effects are actually multiplied when you spend even more time evaluating kids on more criteria in more subjects. So part of the problem is a larger body of research showing that the more you get kids focused on how well they're doing in school, the less they tend to be engaged with what they're doing in school. They're focused on levels of achievement, not layers of understanding. And rubrics focus kids' attention even more fixedly on how well they're doing now with respect to more different criteria. And now they're not saying, to take a very concrete example, how can I write a story that will grab the attention of my reader? They're saying, is this a four? And is it a four on all the segmented parts on or topic organization and use of evidence and all of that? The more you get kids trying to get good rubric scores, the more you've lost them as learners. And what's really amazing is the number of teachers who understandably hate standardized tests but think nothing of smuggling standardization in through the back door, which is precisely what rubrics do.
Yeah, that reminds me, in fact, when I wrote for Huffington Post, I wrote a piece about my son who, doing a writing assignment, started off his what was supposed to be, according to the rubric, an exciting story. He started it off with woo-hoo, and we got called to the teacher, and she said, according to the rubric, this is not an opening sentence. He would, and you know, it's like, and so it proves your point, though. Here he was trying to go with the idea of an exciting story and right. Using woo-hoo, but the rubric said you don't do that.
Well, some teachers and consultants will respond, well, that was just a stupid rubric. All we have to do is get good rubrics, just improve the quality. And I think that's a very seductive but ultimately very dangerous position, because I think the problem is not with the type of rubric and the particulars of what it calls a four or a three. The problem is with the very idea of rubrics, which are based on two things. First, assuming that you can break something into its component rubricizable parts, a very behavioristic, mechanistic notion. And second, that you can then quantify success at each of those little bitty parts. So it's about reductivism. And it's about the behaviorist tendency to assume that you can measure rather than just assess things. And that's those two. The more you know about learning, the more you know that those are two very serious mistakes. And they will become the tail that wags the dog in this classroom. Because if you have to reduce things to a rubric, then you will start teaching the kind of stuff that is reducible to a rubric, and your teaching will become more trivial in order that you can produce crisp scores with high inter-rater reliability, which means standardized, so that you and I give a three to the same thing.
I think that's a point there that a lot of people don't think about. Teaching, we talk about the effects of rubrics on learners, but the effects of rubrics then on a teacher, where you went there, and how it will actually control their behavior as a teacher to not be, you know, just say it simply, not be the best educator, and in fact
that's absolutely right.
Okay.
Yes. You can, I mean, it's easier to devise a rubric for correct use of punctuation than it is to devise a rubric on having wonderful ideas. And so the more constrained you feel to produce a rubric, the more you're going to teach stuff that's less important. And you're going to try to and then take pleasure and pride in your spurious objectivity because you've come up with ratings for this. You know, everything, and it's not just writing. I mean, there is human subjectivity. Human judgment is shot through everything we do, including how we set up a math class and assess students' solutions of math problems. That's just because it's math and there's a right answer, or because you got an 83, doesn't mean this is objective compared to more less numerical forms of assessment. The teacher had to decide which topics were worth teaching and in what order, and how much each topic or question was worth and why. There's rubrics are a great example of an attempt to deny the reality and the value of human subjectivity, to hide behind numbers. And, you know, it's based on this notion that the more data we have, which again is all about quantification, the better. But that's not true, especially in light of that research I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, showing that the more you get kids focused on how well they're doing on their performance, the less excited they tend to be in writing itself, or science, or making an elegant translation, or whatever it is. So I'm not arguing that we shouldn't or can't assess the quality of what kids are doing. I'm saying that rubrics are just grades on steroids, which undermine the quality of the things we think we're just objectively measuring.
Well, I can say woo-hoo to that.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
Elizabeth Hine, founding dean of the School of Education, Metropolitan State University, Denver, joins us now to take on that ever-important Alfie Cohn question. What are the schools our children deserve?
The schools our children deserve are schools that have excellent teachers, excellent school leaders, who deeply understand the diversity of their children and the families in the communities they serve.
Time now for our salute to legendary historian and activist Howard Zinn. This is your moment of Zinn.
Small acts, when multiplied by millions of people, can change the world.
My thanks to Jason Glass, Jen Doucette, Alfie Cohn, Elizabeth Hind, Matt Damon's mom, and of course you, the Busted Pencil listener. Hey, follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. Subscribe to us and write a review in iTunes and Google Play. Get more news and hear past shows at BustedPencils.com. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Thanks for busting pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.